Book Talk Conversation. I'm Christopher G. Moore. I'd like to invite you to join me on Book Talk Conversations, where I turn back the clock, asking an original thinker to discuss their childhood reading. I dig deep into the guest's early books. Follow me down the rabbit hole with a distinguished guest from various fields in the arts and sciences. My great pleasure to welcome as a guest someone I wanted to talk to about books for quite a long time, Shadi Bartsch, who is at the University of Chicago, who's headed up the classics department there, who is a world-renowned scholar, translator of the great Greek and Roman literature. Her works on Seneca, on translation, are legendary, been published by the University of Chicago Press, and she has a new book out, Virgil's Aeneid, by Random House, which has had absolutely rave reviews, saying it's the best translation in modern English, and it was selected by The Guardian in England as one of the top books of 2020. Now, I think if you have a translation of a book that's 2,500 years old and it makes a top 20 list of a Guardian newspaper reviewers list, that is a huge accomplishment. What I'd like to do before opening up is just to say a few words about Shante's list of 10 books. Now, I want to give you my kind of takeaway before we start, having gone through the list and of the books, is that when you look at a person's early reading history, you're looking for telltale signs of what were the elements that really influenced their worldview. Now, one of the things that I loved about the books that Shanti is going to be talking about is the accidental and contingent nature of life and of language, and that how that contingent nature is something that we often don't think about very much. That everywhere, if you look hard enough, the fingerprints of the past are everywhere on our beliefs, our sense of self, and our community. And by looking at these early books, I think we get an insight into the book reader's inner world. In other words, books are a way, a training set for the data for cognition. And so with that, I'd like to start with the first of the books, which is Charlotte's Web. Charlotte's Web is a book which Shante has told me she started reading when she was 10 years of age. So I think we can start there before we get into the Odyssey, which we both want to spend time talking about. But Charlotte's Web, 10 years old, give us a little bit of the context, the background. You're not this distinguished, world-renowned scholar. You're a 10-year-old child. Where is this 10-year-old child located in the world at 10? Because I know you, from your family background, you were living in many places. Can you kind of recreate what that context was so that we have a way of trying to put the clock back to see what you were at 10, where you were?
Absolutely. But first of all, Christopher, let me say thank you. Because it's not usual for me to have people interested in how what I've read has shaped who I am. I'm not particularly well known despite your generous introduction. So thank you for your interest. So Charlotte's Web. When I mentioned Charlotte's Web to you, I was really thinking about its role in how I've come to think about the relationship between animals and humans. And in one of your earlier comments, you said that one of the amazing things about Charlotte's Web was the use of language, the fact that Charlotte, the spider, is weaving words into her web, and it's the unusual fact that these words are in a spider's web, and they describe Wilbur the pig as some pig, or humble, or any one of the other words. It's that unusual fact that leads to his survival, actually, on the farm. The farmer doesn't want to kill a famous pig. What I took away from that was, to me, disturbing. Because when we talk about the rift between animals and humans, we often point to two things. One of them is the fact that animals do not speak, at least not in languages we interpret it. And the second is that animals are supposedly not rational, and that also is another dividing line between us and the animals. So E.B. White, in order to make his pig Wilbur the star and an object of affection for the readers, had to give Wilbur and Charlotte the capacity for speech and the capacity for rational thought. And it's through this medium, I think, that many young readers learn how to identify with them. They think and speak as we do. And that's not true in the real world. And if we look for that in the real world, we'll always be able to claim that animals are distinctively different from humans. So Charlotte's Web both introduced me into the world of animals and their potential suffering and the practical facts of what goes on a farm. But it also laid out for me the traditional distinctions between the animal and the human, and how, in order to transcend these, E.B. White basically had to make his pig and his spider and all the other barn animals human.
I think that's a very interesting starting point. Where were you living at the time when you first came across Charlotte's Web? Was it a gift from your mother or father or teacher? Or
you know, I can't remember. The first book I actually remember getting as a gift was a children's version of The Odyssey from my father, which was interesting because my father traveled all the time and usually didn't bring me gifts, but for some reason this appealed to him. Charlotte's Web, gosh, I don't know. Who can remember when they read Charlotte's Web? It's so ingrained in our childhood experience, right?
Yes. One of the things that I thought, looking at that book in context of the other books that are on your list, is really the use of the web. I mean, what's interesting is the web becomes a structure of language that allows communications across the species. And not just between Charlotte and Wilbur, the spider is able to use a structural architecture from nature and to adapt and adjust that architecture in such a way to reach out to touch other people. And that so shocked people at the fair that basically the second farmer, which had Wilbur, decided this celebrity pig should not be slaughtered for bacon, but was able to have its own personality. Suddenly the animal was just not walking meat to be harvested, but a personality. Someone that had worth and individuality, had feelings, had hopes, had dreams. Charlotte weaved Wilbur's dreams, his personality, his wants in such a way that he's humanized. He's not just a pig. And so as a result, there you have the at age 10 years old, a paradigm of how language structure, once it's there, you have to alter what you weave in the structure. The main thing is to start with the structure in it. To me, that's what I think E.P. White provided someone like you to go on from, to see this kind of way that you weave language from what is a natural capacity. In other words, we don't think of a spider's web as having a language facility. That's what E.P. White opened up, it seems to me, for maybe a 10-year-old who may have been in London at the time. Here is a world of language, and here is a way of communication. Animals are not that other. They just have a different way of communicating with us. And if we listen to that, we can hear the voice. And the voice comes from nature. The structure of language doesn't come from beyond. It comes from an innate nature that he's evolved.
Christopher, that is such a beautiful story, but I'm going to push back against it a little bit, which is that it's not actually Wilbur who is able to express himself. It's Charlotte, the spider, who does it for him. And it's very ironic, I think, given the present circumstances, that she does it through a web, right? The web is the medium of communication, like the World Wide Web today. So yes, she takes advantage, the spider takes advantage of this amazing ability to communicate cross species, which I think we could honor today if we wanted to, but we don't. So language isn't the medium of cross species interaction, of course. It's empathy, and it's the capacity to suffer, right? And while Charlotte's web made me think about animals as human-like beings, it also, I think, in the end, reinforces the fact that because animals cannot manipulate logic or language, we inevitably think that they are different or lesser. And if you want me to go into this whole etiology of this thought, I can certainly do so, which is that... in the Western philosophical tradition, going all the way back to Plato, there are certain characteristics that are set to separate humans from animals in a very absolute way. So, you know, maybe on a Christian reading, it would be the soul or the capacity to do good. But on this Platonic reading, it's that animals are dumb brutes and humans are godlike in their manipulation, again, of logic and language. And I think we need to get rid of logic and language because as ways of thinking about animals, because I think it's actually a impediment now. So on the one hand, E.B. White led us into the mind of animals and created a lot of empathy there. But on the other hand, on second thoughts, as an older person, I feel like the only way he was able to do this was by giving animals what they lack, which is not going to be a solution. And I should also preface all of this by saying I am, or would like to be, a very animal rights type person who has read Jonathan Safran Foer and Steven Pinker, and who really deplores what's going on in factory farms today. So that is my whole connection to Charlotte's Web. The question of, is the only reason we're treating animals differently the fact that they don't speak? And if that's it, should that really be the reason? Wouldn't maybe something like the capacity to have empathy, which we know animals have, shouldn't that maybe be an alternative reason?
It's a very good point.
I'm sorry, I've sucked you into my pro-animal discourse here, clearly.
No, that's fine. I think it's a very valid way of interpreting this particular classic piece of literature. I think part of it as well, and I'd be interested in your view, is whether it's also a book about power and language. Because humans had power over Wilbur, and Wilbur was going to be slaughtered first and at Fern's main farm. She manages to save him. And then the second time is at the county fair, and he saved a second time. So in a sense, he spared the axe because of the word. And there's a certain kind of power there that comes from language. To think that the reason Wilbur was spared had not so much to do with Wilbur, but his friendship with a spider named Charlotte. And Charlotte, through the power of manipulating that web, was able to express words. Those words stop the sword from ending Wilbur's life. Now that, I think, is a relatively beautiful story that leads into your entire career. Because many of the books that you have on your list are about this dance between power, authority, and language, and how we navigate in a quite uncertain, accidental, contingent world, step by step, and how our language in some ways is our guide through those blind alleys.
That's very interesting, and I think you've raised a number of issues. One of them is the relationship of language to power, and we can certainly talk about the wielding of language, the wielding of propaganda, the wielding of attractive national narratives in order to create and sustain certain kinds of power. But we could also talk about the way in which our relationship to the world is inevitably mediated by language. And what I mean by that is not something quite so blunt as the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis that says essentially that our experience of the world is only language and that shapes our mental perspective as well, but something slightly subtler, which one understands immediately upon learning foreign languages, which is that the way language structures one's experience of reality from culture to culture is really different. And just to give a few examples from Mandarin, where I was so struck by this, you know, first I learned certain terminology like ma shang, which means immediately. And then I learned that it actually means on horseback. So here we have a remnant of the ancient culture where the quickest way to get to somewhere was on horseback, not by foot or running. Or the Chinese word for contradiction, which is mao dun, which means sword and shield, right? It's very concrete. And that comes from an old story that said a man was selling, if it's still on screen, he was selling swords that could pierce through any shield, but he was also selling shields that could withstand any sword. And out of that story came the idea of a contradiction being based on sword and shield. So here, embedded in the language are cultural artifacts and insights into history. And I love that. And I think that's true of any language, and that by learning other languages, you are in effect partially learning other points of view. Now, I'm not sure if we could say that of Wilbur and Charlotte. I've never really known where Charlotte got her capacity to write English from. Maybe Mandarin would have been harder. I don't know, but
it's an interesting idea to explore, because in a sense, what Charlotte is doing is she's a translator. She has to translate into a human language. So that, in a sense, is your first introduction to translation. And this way, you have to translate in such a way to touch other people emotionally. To save someone from the sword is to make an emotional appeal. It's an appeal that humanizes the person or the animal you're seeking to save. I think, you know, one of the things that was interesting is about when the owner of the pig asked the doctor about this miracle of a spider being able to use language to communicate all these wonderful characteristics of Wilbur the pig. How can this be? And the doctor's reply was simply, the real miracle is that from nature, a spider can make a web. To make a web itself is a miracle. It's less of a miracle to use that web once it's structured for other purposes, because that's what evolution does. It gives us the original structure, which we can then adapt. So look, the thing is now you read this when you were 10. And before we go back to that, one further point about Charlotte's web, which I think is very important. I want your view on that, is the ending, where, not to be a spoiler, but Charlotte dies. And I mentioned that I was going to have this conversation with you to a friend, an Australian. He says, I read that when I was 11, and I'm a boy, I cried. I think this ending made a lot of people cry, and it still does today. And part of it is her 514 offsprings. suddenly go off into the wind into these little balloons of webs. And in other words, carrying that heritage. In other words, why Charlotte died, she was regenerated 514 times through her progeny. That web was cocooned them, that sent them into the world with that structure, that capacity, that ability to translate the world. And I think it's kind of a wonderful message that we're left with. It's one linked with sadness, but also with hope, and says something about what all species really are.
Yes. It's a very beautiful and sad ending. You know, Charlotte dies. It's her natural lifespan that's come to an end. But Wilbur helps her eggs get back to the farm, and they hatch, and most of them leave, but three stay with him. And he's comforted by the continuity of Charlotte and Charlotte's children, which is, it's really touching. But it also reminded me of this famous Homeric simile that the lives of mankind are like leaves on the trees. And every fall, they pile up at the base of the tree, and then every spring there's new leaves. But it's a cycle that just goes by and by and by. And it's a humbling reminder of how our space here, and I know I'm getting away from your point, but how our space here in the 21st century is just another generation of leaves. And I think we forget that. We have a teleological view of where we're headed. You know, we are Charlotte's children. We are the endpoint of the book. Actually, we're not. We're simply just a means of passing on some genetic material and hopefully making a better world in the process, but not always.
Right. I think we can probably leave Charlotte's web for the moment, because I think that's a good introduction to the Odyssey, which you read very early on. Now, the Odyssey, from my research, it reminded me a little bit. Hopefully, we're going to have time to talk about Richard Rorty. Richard Rorty is one of your authors that was influential to me as well. And one of the things I found very interesting, Rorty grew up, when he was 12 years old, rather than reading the Odyssey, which your father gave you, his parents gave him a 2-volume read set of the collected work of Trotsky. And so Trotsky became kind of a foundational basis for that worldview. Now, with the Odyssey, what's very impressing at 12 years old is the Odyssey is, as I understand, is like 12,000 lines long, you know, it in 24 parts. And when it was performed, it would be performed in 2 to 3 hour segments, 4 different times. So that's between 8 and 12 hours of performance. You must have had an enormous amount of concentration to be able to read that, the Odyssey at age 12. Just give us a little bit of that original experience you had, if you can recreate that for us, not as a scholar you are now, but when you were 12. You open the page and you're starting to read this ancient poem.
Right there in the first line of the Odyssey, you read that Odysseus was an ancient Greek, and I didn't come to it in ancient Greek the first time around, obviously, but you read that he was polutropos, which means he was a man of many turns. And what that seems to mean in context is that as he traveled, he was able to adapt himself to the people and cultures that he met on the way. And one of the most common scenes in the Odyssey is of Odysseus in some foreign land, explaining who he is to his hosts, and through his language gaining safety, shelter, a meal, and so forth. But his story changes a little bit each time, and he doesn't say he's Odysseus. He characterizes himself as someone else. And so, in a sense, the whole epic is about being polutropos, being a person of many turns in language, right? The way that you find security, the way that you adapt, the way that you survive is by understanding the language and the values of different communities and adapting yourself to those. And this had a lot of impact for me because I had already been dragged around the world several times. And literally island to island, you know, Indonesia to Fiji to some parts of Melanesia, etc. And I too, in each case, had to learn to adapt as an outsider. We were never the kind of privileged, wealthy immigrants. We were always the half impoverished kids of a United Nations economist who specialized in the third world. I resonated with that part of Odysseus's experience, but I also missed what Odysseus had at the end, which is he had a nostos, a homecoming. And even if it was rather bloody, I think we can say, throughout his journeys, he had a goal that was to return home to Penelope. And in the end, he did. And Penelope was there waiting. And this was his home. And what I realized is that I had no such telos or goal. I had no such home. And so the question for me became, what do you do when you are homeless? And, you know, not literally homeless in the sense of being out in the open, but homeless in the sense that you can't identify with any one country as where you belong. And I think on the one hand, this was very bad, and it led to a lot of self-doubt because you can't cleave unto any particular system of thought if there's a new one every 2 years. But on the other hand, there may have been good in it too, which is that in seeing the different but deeply felt beliefs of different cultures, you also came to understand that your own view was not the only or the natural or the better one, even if it was, say, Western, right? So that experience with, how to put it, maybe just an inherent respect for the values of other cultures that may not be the values of 21st century America.
You know, that's very interesting to hear that analysis, because in a sense, what you're saying is you're reading this and you're saying, I don't have an Ithaca in my life. I have a journey, but no Ithaca. So what do I do with this life of wandering? Because when you wander, you think of there's a place you return to. And Ithaca is the place you return to. So all of the focus in the Odyssey is the single-minded determination of one king, one man, to undergo all of these ordeals from lotus-eating, memory-eating, monsters and cyclops and the rest of it, to reach that ultimate goal. To be reunited with his kingdom, with his wife, with his son, with his people. Now, your background, when you've been in Indonesia and Fiji and all kinds of other places as a UN kid, you must have thought there must be some comfort in lives of people who have an Ithaca to go to. Because
I was so jealous of those people.
I would have thought that maybe at 12 you said there are people from ancient times who felt like I feel now. I feel I want an Ithaca. I want to follow this person because they know where they're going. They know there are going to be obstacles, but they know that none of that will stop them at the end of the day. So
I
can see how that would have grabbed you at 12 years old. I don't know, maybe you were in Jakarta when you read this. I'm not sure.
I was in Jakarta, yes, I think.
Okay, so I've been to Jakarta. I'm in the neighborhood of that, of Indonesia. So yes, I can understand that was not your Ithaca, and you were looking for something, and Homer opened that door for you. And it's a
he
door
did.
That you went through. Now,
it's also a door that I ultimately gave up on.
Oh, tell me about
because,
that.
Because, well, I don't have a Nostos, right? There's no Penelope
right.
waiting anywhere. And
right.
I think what happens under those circumstances is you give up the idea of a geographical home and you start thinking instead about the possibility of a home in your mind, a place
right.
where you feel comfortable with who you've slowly come to be and the decisions that you've made. And one of the reasons that, skipping ahead a little bit, I like Richard Rorty so much is that he offers a way of uniting all these different worldviews of different cultures and the resultant relativism of values with a stable sense of self, which, if you like, we can talk about later. Let's see, I was going to say something else, and I think it was about language. But I have forgotten it. I won't look at my notes. Well, I will look at my notes, but it's not going to help me. Oh, I know what I was going to say. I was going to say that even before the chaos of this of the Odyssean wanderings, I was already homeless because of the cultural clash of my two parents, one of whom was from Iran and one of whom was born in the US but had a whose genealogical background was from Sweden. And I think if you want to talk about the clash of cultures, Swedish-Iranian is a pretty good idea of just how badly cultures can clash. The other thing about Odysseus that I think appealed to me is that in one of these famous moments in the epic, the Cyclops wants to know who he is, wants to know his identity. And Odysseus says to the Cyclops, "I am Utis," which means in ancient Greek, no one. I am no one. Later, when he blinds the Cyclops and puts out his single eye, the Cyclops screams, and his neighbor Cyclops all say, "What's the matter, Cyclops?" Polyphemus, that was his name, and he says, "Hurting me," to which they all say, "Well, go back to sleep then," or something along those lines. And the idea that you can be no one and that this will protect you, I found very intriguing as well. Maybe it's not about having an identity. Maybe it's about a certain fluidity of identity. In the end, he finally announces his name to the Cyclops as he's escaping on his boats. He says, "I'm Odysseus, wahaha! I'm the guy who blinded you, I'm awesome." And the Cyclops throws a rock at the boat and just narrowly misses it. So it was that moment of self-identification as Odysseus, which almost led to his destruction. And it's very hard not to read a moral into that in some ways.
You know, what's interesting on the issue of identity, I think identity
yes.
is an interesting part because upon returning to Ithaca, he assumes the role of a beggar. In other words, a demeaning position. And even his wife, Penelope, does not recognize him. There are 108 suitors who are in the palace grounds and the rest of it, and he's waiting his moment. So there is an ability to assume a variety of identities. There is no one single identity to him. What there is a single-minded purpose. And it shows a wonderful separation between those two things. The teleological purpose-driven person who will assume what persona is necessary at that time to achieve that purpose.
And that can be good or bad, right? I mean, I think the Greeks valued a certain level of wiliness in their heroes, but the Romans certainly did not. And in for example, I think my dog is going through the garbage. And for example, the Aeneid, this idea of Ulysses or Odysseus being many-tongued and able to change his self-representation, that is considered an evil, not a good. So it's also a culturally bound idea, right? You don't want to be the great deceiver after all.
Right, right. But there was a fair amount of deception in the Odyssey.
Oh, there's lots.
And just to tie in one little part with Charlotte's Web, I think at one point half of his crew is turned into swine, into Wilbur's, little Wilbur's.
That's Circe. She turns all his men into pigs. He's the only one who withstands it.
Exactly. Yeah. It said with the Odyssey, basically the king has killed two generations of Ithaca men.
He did.
12 shiploads plus the 108 suitors who are waiting around the palace grounds.
Absolutely.
And so he did dispatch a fair number of people in his singular mission of returning back to Ithaca. And so maybe returning back to a physical place does require a certain degree, not only of deception and wildliness, but a certain kind of appetite for violence as well.
Gosh, I hope not. I can't imagine myself going back to my birthplace, London, wielding a scimitar and decapitating people. I mean, that sounds very violent. But I was struck by, so you mentioned Circe turning Odysseus's men into pigs, right?
Right.
Kind of a faint recall of Wilbur there. And I'd always read this without thinking about it until I started reading books that retold classical myth from the point of view of the woman who was given no voice usually in that classical myth. So here I'm going to do a shout out to Madeline Miller, who wrote a book called Circe, about Circe's experience of being Circe. And if you think about it, it's actually incredibly logical that she would want to turn these men into pigs if she could. Imagine you are a woman all by yourself on an island, presumably an attractive woman, and you're doing your weaving and singing your songs, and then these boatloads of desperate, haggard, hungry men arrive from the shores of Troy, right? They haven't seen a woman in 10 years. There is, I don't know, 100 of them, and there's Circe weaving, right? And so what Miller points out is probably, you know, in terms of war stories, the next thing that would have happened is that they would have raped and murdered her. And it was a very good thing that she turned them into pigs. So there has been recently a whole wave of rethinking classical mythology and epic through the voices of the people who don't get to say anything in the epics. And that has been, I think, a great reimagining of the classics, especially in this day and age, where we don't want the classics to be about sovereignty, superiority, colonialism, etc. We want it to be about understanding that different countries have different traditions, that epics about conquering can still be taught in a way that disavows their supposed ideological intention and so forth. And partly we do this for the recuperation of our voices,
Maybe that's why it's a great classic, because each new age can rediscover aspects of itself and its current preoccupations and values and notions of identity by reinterpretation. What I'm interested is, you read this when you were 12, and I have a feeling you read this multiple times after age 12. It was a book that you kept going back to?
Yes. After all, it's my field, right?
Yeah, but when you were 12 years old, this is not your field, right? You're still a kid. In school,
no,
right?
When I was 12 years old, it was my field. I was a little bit precautious.
Okay.
One of the reasons I liked Odysseus is that in the Iliad at least, it says very clearly, okay, Odysseus is not much to look at, and maybe he's not the greatest warrior ever, but he has the gift of the gab. right? And as a very nerdy kid who didn't fit in well with my peers or who was always the outsider, this was a possible liberation, right? To have the gift of the gab. It didn't matter if you were the worst person in your team and were always chosen last. You had something else you could point to. So I really hung on to that. And I think maybe in some ways I was kind of a classicist at an early age.
So in other words, it gave you confidence that somehow being different wasn't a bad thing.
It started to give me confidence. I'm still working on it.
We all are.
That's good to hear. So,
the next book I'd like to turn to is William Golding's The Lord of the Flies, which is one of my favorites as well. And to see, you know, this kind of, again, the tension between civilization and power we're starting to kind of, it seems to me, develop a little bit of a notion that your reading has been about journey, tragedy, destiny, cruelty, authority, control, miracles, gods, and natures. And I think the Lord of
depressing.
The Well, it's not so much depressing. You know, sometimes when you have a realistic view of the world, other may think it's depressing. But if you're reading literature closely, what it's saying is tragedy is always nearby. Be prepared. Try to understand more deeply that this is not personal to you. This is the nature of living in a contingent world that you can't control. The circumstances.
Okay, now you are channeling Martha Nussbaum, Richard Rorty, William Golding, and a bunch of other people all at the same time, and they're all saying slightly different things, but you're touching all of them. So this is a ginormous topic, right? In other words, the contingency is of life. Is it or is it not so overwhelming that it will destroy your values?
Correct.
And in one of the other readings, it's actually Martha Nussbaum's reading of Hecuba in The Fragility of Goodness. She shows a woman who is absolutely convinced that nobility of purpose, not nobility of blood, she talks about nobility of rearing and purpose, continues to have meaning even in an unjust world. And she clings to this belief until it's torn from her by the final act of violence in the play, which is the murder of her son by a guest friend. And at that point, she gives up. And basically, in the play, she turns into a dog. And that doesn't mean she turns into a fluffy, kind pooch who likes treats. It means that she turns into something that is outside of and detached from society, because she can no longer cling to the beliefs that society creates in order to maintain stability. Like, there are gods and they will punish good and evil. She has to give that up. Just as Richard Rorty has to give that up when he talks about giving up one's final vocabulary. And what he means by final vocabulary is literally all those value words that can't be given a definition because they are the final word in a series of definitions. So if you boil things down to their very end, how do you define the good or the just or the valuable? You can't. They're things that are meant to stand on their own as ipso facto valuable. But if you don't believe in those ipso facto words that represent your moral, your final vocabulary, what do you do? What do you do if you're a Hecuba, basically, and you've given up?
Yeah. It's like, what do you do when you are a bunch of young adolescents are isolated on an island? And so the question is how do they interact? What set of values do they choose in which to govern themselves as boys? And so what Golding, it seemed to me, was doing in Lord of the Flies was trying to set up these contradictions, these possible alternatives, and in a way, looking how close we all are to going back to a kind of savagery, and that savagery is something that is lurking ever present. It's not something that goes away in some kind of utopian flash. That the Lord of the Flies is about that descent and the attempt to cushion that descent in this community of young boys.
Absolutely. And one of the great things about Lord of the Flies is that the community of young boys are British. And that goes along with all the associations of that period when Golding was writing, was that I think it was in the 60s. Stiff upper lip, the epitome of civilization, et cetera, et cetera. But what the allegory seems to me to be about is essentially a political allegory, because the first thing these boys do when they decide to organize themselves on the island is essentially they set up a democracy, not unlike Athenian democracy, in which whoever holds the conch, the shell, has the right to speak.
Sure.
And this is actually like the scepter in the Iliad. But despite this starting point, as you know, they disintegrate through essentially the lust for personal power that is felt only among a few, but it's enough to throw the system into disarray. The conch gets destroyed. The unpopular boys are murdered, at least two of them. And it becomes the rule of the tyrant, right? Jack the Tyrant. And what's curious about this disintegration of democracy into tyranny, is that it's a theme that's echoed so often in ancient Greek political writing, where in Plato, for example, democracy always ends up as tyranny. And how is that? Well, democracy slowly disintegrates into a political system in which demagogues take over, because the people no longer are interested in contributing to the whole. They're more interested in what they can get out of it. And the demagogues promise them what they can get out of it, lower taxes, say. And at this point, the values of the state are completely undermined by personal greed. And then inevitably the demagogue claims that he's in danger from enemies and needs a personal bodyguard. And you might be thinking about January 6th here in that quote unquote personal bodyguard. And through that bodyguard, the tyrant, who was previously a democratic leader, seizes power and democracy evolves, as is its nature to. And, you know, people have said this is simplistic, and it is simplistic, but I think we were giving a harrowing insight into what that might look like at the end of this past presidency, where the democratically elected leader seemed determined to hang on to power at all costs. And there are, across the world, democratically elected leaders who do that. Those are illiberal democracies, democracies in which somebody is democratically voted into power, but who afterwards does not sustain the values of liberal democracy, like the right to a trial, the right to free expression, the right to a press, and so forth.
You know, what's interesting about the Lord of the Flies is that not long into the book, you really descend into the world of these adolescent boys. What's interesting, again, is our endings in books. Endings in Lord of Flies is being rescued by adults. And suddenly they all become little 11, 12-year-old boys again, crying and whiny and emotional. You know, all of that hubris, all of those tactics and planning by Jack, the tyrant, Ralph, who was the Democrat, who's now dead. All of these things quickly fade into the background. So in the real world, there is no rescue ship that comes to the island that brings the boys back into civilization.
Aha. I would say there, in the real world, there is a rescue ship but it looks exactly like what it's come to rescue. So that Navy officer who finds, who is it who's collapsed at his feet? One of the boys. He says something like, oh yeah, he's so disappointed that British boys should be so savage, right? You know, like that. And then he turns around and he looks behind him at his own warship, which is what he came to the island on. And the book is set in the middle of an unspecified war where people are apparently, as wars encouraged, killing each other for no good reason except for the extension of the power of the people who lead the country. So the British officer may seem to represent a rescue back into civilization, but what we really end up, I think, seeing is that civilization writ large is the same thing as the island of the boys writ small.
I think it's a good point. In other words, there is no rescue. There's only the illusion of being rescued because you're being rescued by people in power who basically are using means of destruction which are vastly more effective as killing machines than these young boys on an island.
At least in this novel, yes.
Yes.
A bit of a bleak vision.
Yeah, it's a bit of a... And again, you read this at age 12, about the same time you were reading The Odyssey. So how did the book come to you? Was it a gift from your father or your mother or school library or...
You know, Christopher, I knew that you were going to be asking me questions like this, and even with forethought, I wasn't able to answer them because I read like a maniac the whole time, and I can't remember how specific books came to me. I was a kid who got into trouble when the parents did a sudden check at 3 a.m. and their daughter was hiding under the covers with a flashlight reading. That was me. I mean, they took the book away and they yelled at me and said, get some sleep. So I can't answer your question about the circumstances that well, but I can say that it raised all these questions that are perennial questions that are still around today, I'm gonna bite the bullet. Is democracy always the best bet?
Right. I think it's a very real question, and it's a question that certainly the first three books have answers too. And the fourth book, Arrow of God by Chinua Achebe is a wonderful, wonderful book.
It's amazing. It's
an absolutely amazing piece of literature, which takes us into the whole realm of, again, democracy, civilization, colonialization, and the contradictions that come. As along with, I think one of the things that I know you've written about with regard to language, perhaps one of the more compelling parts of Arrow of God is the worst part of colonialization was to dismantle the language of belief of local people. Because once you deprive them of their belief system by taking away their language of expression and trying to substitute another language,
absolutely,
you create an emptiness, a void. And that's what this book is about, of someone, the local Igbo priest, Izulu, who tried to preserve his local traditions and belief systems. Because, they had this notion of duality, right? For everything that exists, something stands beside it. Everything that exists, something stands beside it. That the supernatural world, the dead and the unborn and the living are all interconnected. And their language, like Charlotte's Web, weaved a language around that structure of belief. And what the colonial part of the book suggests is basically that whole web was destroyed and a new one put in, totally alien to the people of this village or of this tribe.
Absolutely. I mean, the vision that book offers of a British missionaries imposing their view of Christianity to the religion of the Igbos is really a kind of a shocking and disturbing thing. And in some ways, ultimately, the joke is on the British, because when the Igbos finally convert to Christianity, at least the generation that converts to Christianity, they do so because they decided that their own most recent god, Ulu, has failed with the crops. And so now they're going to try a different god, which is this, you know, Christian god and the sun and so forth, S-O-N, sun. But the Igbo in this novel do change gods whenever a god is shown to fail. And so their adoption of the Christian god in a way is a continuation of that tradition until the next generation, where the Christian god just becomes what's normal for them. And the whole edifice of Igbo custom and Igbo belief is dismantled. One of the reasons that book was so important to me, apart from the obvious reason that it shows the difficulty of cultures talking to each other across belief structures, and the untranslatability of one religious language into another, is that I taught it in a class once, and there's a very moving scene in the book in which a particular man's spirit manifestation, I can't remember if it's a stick or a sculpture, but it's broken by his enemy. And as this is broken, his soul, his spirit is broken. He looks at it, he feels dead. You know, it's like the Aboriginal boy in Walkabout, who thinks he sees death in the eyes of the Western girl looking at him, and who then dies, right? So it's a very strong belief structure in the supernatural that is very closely tied to your own welfare. And I was talking about this in class, and not only could I see that a lot of the students didn't get it, but some of them thought it was funny. Like, this is so ridiculous. How could somebody be crushed because a stick was broken? And that hurt. That was painful for me. I didn't want to be in a society where people would think that. I wanted to be in a society where, as it were, we would honor each other's sticks, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Each other's sacred values. Yeah.
Well, it's a little bit, again, the symbolism, again, of Lord of the Flies with the couch, the shell. Once you hold that, you have a certain status to speak. Not just to speak, but to be heard, to be listened to. And in some ways, the irony between these two books, between Arrow of God and Lord of the Flies, again, it's ways of dealing with savagery, that there is at core a potentially barbaric nature that every culture has a way of trying to address. But if you knock that out and you see what happens with having a war of replacement of value system in Lord of the Flies, and you see when it's imposed from a colonial point of view, that you have to deal with savagery in our belief system. Your system is
absolutely
one that doesn't work. And to me, that's the essence of that beautiful book, Arrow of God, is that each culture has its own way of dealing with the savage nature that we are and the contingencies of life within that nature.
And when the Christians imposed their beliefs on the Igbos, on the Igbo singular, I think that is another form of savagery. I think that we are led to ask, who are the real savages here? The ones who want to be left alone, or the ones who want to impose their belief system on others?
Right. So that, talking about belief systems, I think we can probably go to Sophocles' Antigon, which is, again, a clash of beliefs, a clash of authority, of control, of power. Again, very much in the theme of the previous books that formed your worldview. So tell us a little bit about Sophocles and Anticon in terms of your development. You read this in your 20s, and you know it goes back again. It's an ancient play from 441 BC. And like Odysseus, what was interesting about the original works, now this is the fifth, and two out of those come out of a tradition of oral storytelling, pre-print, really pre-manuscript in many ways, that these were not read, they were performed, they were sung. There was a stage, there was music, there may have been dancing. There was a kind of a participation that one had with literature at that point that somehow we've decoupled from in many ways. We go to a theater for a particular kind of play, we read a novel or a nonfiction book, but we often read it alone. We don't read it out loud. That would be thought to be odd now. But for most of our history, that was thought to be normal. It would be thought to be very odd to read on your own. That would have been a form of insanity. So, going to Sophocles, give us a little bit of a background of how that came into your life and what impact it had at that point. You must have been in university by this point.
I was. So you've asked several questions in one, I think. One of the questions was about performance versus a written status.
Yes.
And another question was about competing value systems in the Antigone. And a third, well, there's a lot in what you were saying. So just to refresh our audience, if we have an audience, the Antigone is about Antigone's decision to bury one of her brothers, the one who rebelled against the city that she was a citizen of and who tried to destroy it, Polynices. And in contraindication to the laws of the king, Creon, but of course this is being performed in a democratic context, so Creon's status is difficult to assess. So she does this in contraindication to his commands, and it becomes essentially, well, many people have thought it's essentially about a conflict of values, the close-knit values of the family and responsibilities to the family versus the demands of the state. And that's kind of been a traditional interpretation. And before I get to that interpretation and what I think we need to add to it, I'm just going to say something about your performance versus reading dichotomy, which is that not only were these dramas performed in Athens, but the space in which they were performed mimicked the space of the Pnyx, the political area in which the Athenians gathered to vote. And it was actually considered a responsibility of the Athenian citizens to go to the theater. The theater and its performances were embedded in a Dionysiac festival that lasted for several days. It was a matter of religion and politics. It was not a matter of entertainment, right? So very different from how we think about going to the theater, right? Just not the same, just not even related.
Yeah, it's like we think of the theater in terms of Harold Pinter and Osborne. But what's interesting here is Sophocles was a general. You had a general writing a play. And so this reinforces your point of the interweaving of the web of the political, the civic,
the communal
life into a point where they can see in a way a kind of a mirror that's being held up that has political reflection as well as social and emotional reflection.
Definitely. In fact, it was the responsibility of the wealthiest man in Athens to pay for part of the production. And this was almost like the payment of taxes, except it wasn't forced on them. It was considered a morally upstanding thing to do as a citizen. So yes, very much embedded in the civic and political nature of the polis, the city-state, but and also very much a mirror, as you said, but an ill-fitting mirror, because the mirror invited the Athenians to think about the corrosiveness of absolute beliefs. And again, I think I'm going out on a limb a little bit here, but Antigone does not know the meaning of compromise. She only recognizes the value of family. Everybody she addresses as their relationship to her. So her sister is kind of, you know, like person who was in the same womb as me, that kind of thing. And Creon, the leader, is obsessed with civic order and the idea that the good of the polis, of the city-state, is the major good, not the good of the individual. And I don't think what we have here is only a clash of values, although it is that. It's a clash of what happens when you have only one value system and you are unable to recognize others. So she cannot recognize the claims of the city-state, and he cannot recognize the claims of the family. And the result is, you know, death and disaster. And I think that is really telling. There are some modern readings of the Antigone that claim that Antigone is totally right and Creon is totally a tyrant. But the problem is that's a very anachronistic reading, because in ancient Greek, to have a young woman like Antigone outside of the house, in the dark, at night, by herself with her sister, planning an act that has been forbidden by law in the city, this is not a normal woman. This is not a woman whom the Greeks would embrace and say, woo, you know, early feminism, go Antigone. That's not what the response would have been at all. Their response would have been suspicion and a sense that she was alien. And indeed she was, because if you think about the family she comes from, right, her father is the son of her mother, Oedipus and Jocasta. That's a family that is completely screwed up in terms of familial relationships. For her to exemplify family values coming from that family is simply another manifestation of something wrong.
Yeah.
So I think we're not supposed to take either Antigone or Creon at face value. We're simply supposed to see the destructiveness of belief systems that are completely rigid.
I'm wondering if a little bit, it takes us back to the journey to Ithaca, is how there are two versions of Ithaca in Sophocles' play, to my mind. One was the family personal one, and the other was the larger communal one of the king. And those two came into conflict. Both of them wanted to go to Ithaca, but they defined Ithaca in radically different ways, in such a way that it was impossible to compromise. If the family is your immediate brother who's deceased, and the rituals of the gods require you to have a burial so that he can transform into the afterlife, that is the single-minded goal. If you're the king, it is the authority for the community that must rise above even the gods in order to protect the community.
Absolutely. And you know what? I think one could push this even further and perhaps a little bit radically suggest that Antigone as an individual could represent the values of liberal democracy, and Creon as an embodiment of the state could represent the values of somewhere like China or Singapore, sure, where the individual is not supposed to be the ultimate locus of value. And indeed, you know, why should the individual be the ultimate locus of value? In the case of the West, it's because we, if I may say we, have inherited that as part of our tradition. In the case of China, it's a Confucian tradition, which has different values. But to say my values are better than your values, I think, is very tricky, although we do it all the time.
Yeah, we do, because values tend to get tied up with identity. And so the people fight very hard to retain their identity. And so if there's an underlying value such as democracy or the autonomous individual self, it's hard for people to step back from that and see that that's just one way of being in the world. It is not the only way. The other people who are in the world in a different way, just like the Arrow of Time, the people in that part of Nigeria were in a different structure. They weave the Charlotte's web, but in a different pattern.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And to destruct that is wanton, I think.
I think so, too. Let's move on to Martha Nussbaum's The Fragility of Goodness. Again, you read this in your 20s, and I think in your note, you said to me, the fragility of goodness with an explanation point. That the question that we have here, again, is this notion of duality, which goes back to Arrow of Time, contingency, Lord of the Flies, Charlotte's Web. So fragility is now added into this. Not only are things happening in an accidental by chance matter, it means the whole infrastructure of reality, of thought and belief is quite fragile. More fragile than people or, please go ahead.
I was just going to say, so in my colleague Martha Nussbaum's reading of that play, which I like very much, the reason Hecuba, one of the central figures, the woman whose last remaining son and daughter are slaughtered by the Greeks, the reason she finally falls apart is not the slaughtering per se, but the dissolution of some of the most sacred bonds in society, like the guest friendship bond.
Right.
And when she sees that there are no values that can be held sacred, she falls apart. She becomes inhuman. And for me, this question of what do you do if the world around you doesn't sustain your values is also kind of a leitmotif in books like Eichmann in Jerusalem, for example, where you've got this, you know, Eichmann on Hannah Arendt's reading, and this is a reading that nobody really agrees with anymore, so I'm not pushing this reading, but on her reading, he's somebody who simply got swept up in the machinery of the Nazi bureaucracy, who wanted to do a good job, who wanted to be praised by the party, who dedicated himself to efficiency, right? Without thinking about so much the outcome of his efficiency.
Sure.
Now, we know from other sources, later letters and interviews, that Eichmann probably was virulently anti-Semitic, and that he did know that what he was doing was not simply carrying out orders. But think about it. If you are in a society where what is defined as good is, say, exterminating a race of people and comparing them to insects, and you are rewarded for that thought system by the highest powers of the land, what is going to happen to you? Are you going to be a Socrates or a Jesus who stands up against those values? Or are you going to be an Eichmann who embraces those values? And how do we know as individuals if what we're rejecting or embracing is good or bad if we don't have a guiding system? Now, religion, of course, is a wonderful guiding system, right? But being Christian didn't mean that the German Nazis represented Christian values, right? So we humans have an uncanny ability to bend values as we need to and to claim that certain things are good under certain conditions, which under other conditions, the Nuremberg trials, are manifestly not good. So this takes us to Richard Rorty, right? How do you behave ethically if you have difficulty subscribing to absolute value systems? In other words, if you can't be an Antigone, if you can't be a Creon, if you're always stuck between different cultural points of view and different value systems, how do you behave ethically? And this for me has been a kind of a lifelong problem. In fact, when I had a shrink, I kept saying to the shrink, but how do I know I'm not a bad person? And she would say, well, you know, bad people don't come to their shrink once a week and say, but what if I'm bad, right? which was a great relief to me. I was like, oh, okay, I'm not bad. But so Richard Rorty, finally, whom I read in my mid-20s, gave me an answer for that. And his answer was, you have to separate out private irony or cynicism about absolute values from public endorsement of those values. In other words, you can be cynical and say there's no God, there's no final vocabulary, there's no system of ethics that is supported metaphysically by something outside ourselves. You can say that to yourself privately, but it's not the basis for a society to be built on, right? And living with that contradiction of endorsing certain values, like I'm against cruelty, in all its forms. I'm against factory farms. I'm against the death penalty. I'm against a lot of things. But I have given up trying to justify those beliefs using a metaphysical system. I just live them and act on them, and that's enough. So I live as this divided persona, and I'm okay with that. I don't think there's another way to live. I think you both have to be skeptical about values and enact those values, which is quite a balancing game.
That's very good. It's a very profound insight. And back to Margaret Nussbaum, she characterizes the difference between Plato looking for forms which are universal and eternal as the place that you go to manufacture your values, to test your ethics, as opposed to Aristotle saying, there are no forms. What we know comes from our experience. What we see, what we perceive, what we understand is from what we have experienced in the world. And we have to make the best of that sensory perception in a way that allows us to have social relationships that minimize conflict, that maximize well-being.
Absolutely. And as you've probably guessed, I'm an Aristotelian in those terms and not a Platonist.
I would have guessed that to be the case, yeah.
But one does come across people who want there to be a truth.
Right.
They want you to say, you know, the things that you believe, but you can't justify, like, you know, murder is bad, cruelty is bad, racism is bad, anti-Semitism is bad, all these things I believe incredibly deeply. And they want you to say these things are truth, as if they were Platonic forms. And I can't make that leap. All I can say is that I believe in them for and of the world. But I think the notion of an absolute truth out there is incredibly dangerous. And I think that people like Immanuel Kant, who try to get there, also open the door to very dangerous ways of living in the world.
I think it's right. And again, going back to Errol of Time, it's the essence of it is it's a very Platonian worldview that underwrites colonialism. We have these universal truths and forms, and we are doing you a service to bring these truths to you. And if you resist that, then unfortunately you're going to have to be punished and otherwise suffer.
Or you'll go to hell. Right? Yeah, so
right.
I think what you're putting your finger on is an essential similarity between Platonism and monotheism, right?
Right.
Christianity, Islam, Judaism. Monotheistic religions are also very particular about their single truth.
Right.
And not particularly flexible around it. Yeah.
Yes. I'd like to move on then to Hannah Arendt, Eichmann in Jerusalem, which is number 8 for David, if you can put that. Yes, that's the cover. And as you've said, you already kind of briefly outlined that this is one of the important books on your list, that you read it in your 30s, and it is, I think, a book everyone should have on their reading list as a look into the psychology of people who are part of an atrocity machine.
The psychology of evil, yes.
And the banality of that evil, of seeing himself basically as a clog. You go along day to day. You never look at the larger picture of what you're doing. It's just simply, here's an invoice. Here's a statement. I have to sign this. I have to do that.
Absolutely.
And restricting the world to that point allows for a kind of underlying savagery to blossom.
Absolutely. You know, let's get this train to Theresienstadt on time, but
right.
Not what is this train doing? Yeah. So as I mentioned earlier, a lot of people took issue with Arendt's interpretation, and it's probably not right, but in a way it doesn't matter because she raises a question, which is, can there be a banality of evil? Can you engage in the evil at a distance without and believing yourself not to be contaminated by it?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a terrifying question. And I was more terrified when I read about Stanley Milgram's experiments, which have also since, to my relief, been apparently somewhat discredited. But as you know, Stanley Milgram, who was actually interested in issues like the banality of evil and what the Nazis did, he signed up a bunch of people and told them that they would be administering minor electrical shocks to people on the other side of a wall who were getting their answers wrong on some quiz or questionnaire. And there was an authority figure in the experiment who had hired the people who were administering the shots, the shocks. And the shockers would say, well, I'm not really comfortable increasing the electrical shock to this person who got this answer wrong. I mean, I can hear cries of pain.
Sure.
And the supervisor said, no, it's fine. Go ahead. And they did. At least this is what Milgram claimed. And gosh, can you imagine being in that situation where the authority figures whose authority you have bought into are telling you it's okay, but you are personally rebelling against it? That takes courage. You know, you have to be a Jesus or a Socrates, I think, again, to do that. And how do you know you're right when you're a Jesus or a Socrates? How do you know that you're not a son of Sam, right, who thinks he's hearing God's voice telling him to do things, but who is actually a crazy madman psycho killer? So, yeah.
I'd like to ask you your view on the Eichmann trial. Is one of the things that comes from the book to me is the notion of accountability of evil. How do you draw account in a public way? And I think Arendt's book is quite brilliant in the sense of saying our legal and technical ways of assessing crime fall apart when you have something at this level, because it's not strictly just a legal issue. I was a reporter years ago in Cambodia covering the trial of the Pol Pot people
you
of
are
that
kidding
regime.
Me.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
I covered that. In fact, I did a major report for the Phnom Penh Press on that. So it was, in a sense, a replay of the same kind of a drama of trying to hold a regime and people in that regime accountable. Now, I think you know, what Arendt said was very true. It's not that you let the Eichmanns of the world go, but what you do is you understand that here is a man who basically said Jews did not have a right to exist. I believe that such a person does not have a right amongst our species. Full stop.
That's what Arendt said about Eichmann, right?
Yeah,
since
exactly.
He thought other people shouldn't exist, he
exactly.
shouldn't exist.
Exactly.
Yeah.
In other words, you separated out a part of our population as not human. We should not accept such a person as part of our population. This is not just a narrow legal issue of what you knew and what you didn't know and when you knew it. This is fundamentally, you were part of this and your statement supported, you were part of the program. You may not have been making speeches, but you believe this.
Christopher, I think that's a really good point coming through you from Aaron. And maybe I want to backtrack a little bit then. Maybe in all of my woe and indeterminacy and cultural relativism and all the other things that plague me, maybe one could say at the end of the day, behaving as if other humans aren't human is unforgivable, no matter what value system you have.
Exactly. And in other words, there is a communal obligation to the species, fundamentally, that you don't single out a group for extermination. This is not a legal issue per se. This is not something you try someone in a court for. This is fundamental to the foundation of what we are as a species.
But then what are you going to do about today with the Rohingya, with the Uyghurs, with our 20th century history of various genocides? When do we learn?
What we learn is we go back to Thucydides. Those who have power, you yield to them, not because you wish, but because you must. And that's where power.
We shouldn't end on that note.
No, we shouldn't end on that at all. But what I'm saying is that is a strain that goes through, that pushes back against a fundamental notion that there are limits to power. We see this again in Sophocles. You know, that there is this balance between the powerful and the exercise of that power against the fundamental beliefs that we all hold.
So you're thinking about the Melian dialogue or the Mytilenean debate, where
exactly.
The Athenians just said, hey, we have the power, so you can argue all the ethics you want, but we're going to squash you at the end of the day anyhow. And that's really disturbing. I don't have an answer for that. If I did, I'd be some famous philosopher. But Plato thought he had an answer, which was that when you do things like massacre the Melians and take their women and children, you are ultimately damaging yourself. And your soul is the thing that also gets corrupted. Your soul will no longer allow you to live a life of peace or happiness because of the hell into which you have dragged it. Now, I don't know if I believe that, because you'd have to believe that all tyrants were deeply unhappy if you believed it. And I don't know, are all tyrants deeply unhappy? But I think it's one of those great questions. You think so? There are some happy tyrants out there?
I think that there are tyrants that are living in their manufactured bubbles that are feeling quite satisfied. In fact, this is a great segue. I think in the last book we can cover would be Rorty's Contingency, Irony, and Solidarity, which I think very much fits into what we're talking about. You were saying, you know, Plato says, you know, look beyond. Rorty says, don't worry about looking beyond. There is no beyond
to look
beyond. To. There is the now, the immediate, that you look to out of experience. And he's Aristotelian as well in that respect. He's not looking for some universal form out there that one size fits all. So that's the last of the books I'd like to discuss. And it's, again, a brilliant book and an insight into your mind of someone who has this incredible worldview of multiple languages, multiple cultures, who is on a lifetime mission of seeing that we don't decouple from our past. That what the Greeks and the Romans were writing is vibrant and important to us today as they were then. We have to understand the context of our language comes from those earlier forms of tradition and rituals and storytelling. Is you're a storyteller, and the stories you're telling are the stories that build upon stories from the past. So I think
I agree with that, which is why I think it's difficult for me now to hear people saying we need to cancel Greco-Roman antiquity, because it's associated with negative values such as slavery, for example. Because frankly, I think pretty much all the Western tradition is associated with negative values. It's not like after the Greeks and Romans died out, we became little saints. Mm-hmm. So that's one argument. The other argument is that for people who get a European or American education, what you are learning is deeply influenced by what these people had to say.
Sure.
Democracy, the rule of law, etc. These are age-old concepts that come from antiquity. And I would never say, let's only teach the Western tradition. I would never say the Western tradition is better, God forbid. But I would say, let's use it and learn from it like any other tradition. And early in this conversation, you almost paraphrased something I said in an editorial in the Washington Post a few weeks back, which is that instead of binding ourselves to interpret texts the way they were interpreted in the past, right? For example, interpreting the Aeneid as a statement in favor of colonization, destroying the natives, et cetera, claiming God is on your side, manifest destiny, westward ho, et cetera, all those things that echo in American history. We have perfect freedom to read it, and it's deep enough to do so, as the opposite of that, as a text that is deeply critical of such ways of thinking and initiatives. And to my mind, as a classics professor, that's part of what the classics are. They are texts that are so complicated and deep that they resonate with almost every different age or different culture that comes along. And we're all able to pull things out of them that have meaning for us. And we're all able to manipulate for the good the authority that some of these texts have garnered over the centuries. So yes, I'm strongly in favor of interpretation and not so much in favor of cancellation, I guess. There was also a great piece in today's New York Times, which said, let's say we succeed in getting rid of all the names of the prior American slave owner, racist, you know, people whose values disgust us today. Let's say we get rid of all those names, right? We topple all the statues, we rename all the buildings. Sure. Then what do we have? We have no reminder of a past that was undesirable. And we have no reminder that we have changed from that past. And I think such reminders are important, right? We have to question ourselves at every generation, and we can't simply cancel the past as bad and say, we good now, right?
We shouldn't be laundering the past. Like intellectual drug dealers, we can only have those bits which come out the other end that are comforting to our worldview. In other words, these worldviews.
That's so dangerous, don't you think?
I think it's dangerous because people, again, are forgetting the contingency and irony of life. And as Royte is saying, is what you're aiming for is a kind of a solidarity amongst people. But you can have solidarity without tearing down the past. It's understanding the past in the context of how the past was shaped, because the social, psychological, and technological environment is relevant. Ideas just don't spring out of the abstract, regardless of what Plato thinks. They spring from a particular culture and a particular time. And it's not like that's frozen in time. We are not living in the time of Sophocles. But emotionally, many of the things that are happening are things that are similar that happened to the ancient Greeks. In other words, we can learn from them and their perception of how they dealt with that and adapt those ideas, those views, to a very modern context. With social media,
absolutely,
for example, you know, suddenly
they also had questions. Yes.
Yes.
I was just going to say they also had questions about big metaphysical issues, as we do. And I think you're absolutely right. And I think that we can practice solidarity among humans, and for that matter, yeah, animals, without a metaphysics.
Yes. And again, it goes back to the Eichmann trial book, right? The large metaphysical question is what is the place for people who step outside of the species and will destroy whole groups? How do we deal with that from a metaphysical point of view? Not a legal point of view or an accounting point of view. Deal with it directly as the metaphysical issue that it actually is.
Well, we've asked some big questions.
I think we've asked some big questions. I think we have put together, hopefully, what will be for the people who watch this video, a portrait of inside of the mind of, as I say, a world-renowned translator of Roman and Greek literature. And it's because of people like you that we're allowed to keep that web weave going. It's like Charlotte's web again, and you're part of keeping the web there for us as a reminder that this is the structure from where we came. This is the structure from where our language came. And because that is the structure, we are adaptable as a species, and we can use that structure with our modern sensibilities in a way to communicate with one another in a way that's meaningful.
Hear, hear.
I want to thank you so much for spending the time to come on the show to talk about the books. And I think it's been very revealing. I think anyone who reads the classics will reread them in a different way, having listened to you talk about the books that shaped your worldview.
The thanks are on my end, Christopher. Thank you for allowing me to express my worldview in a public medium. And hopefully not too many Rotten Tomatoes will come my way afterwards.
I don't think there will be. Thank you very much now. And
thank you.
I hope we'll have a chance to talk again.
That sounds great.
Okay.
Have a wonderful day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.